Hello and welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's episode number 405. My name is James Gilmore. Joining me today is Glenn Fox.
Hello. No Emily today.
I know, you scared her off. You were chatting with her at lunch. What did you say?
Didn't say anything, but I might have killed her.
Jesus Christ, that escalated so quickly.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, she said, like, I don't really like Zelda or something like that, and I just got the blind rage.
Oh man, the Nintendo fanboy rage.
Yeah.
It's when you see red mist. 16-bit mist, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. And she's now red mist, because I punched her into mist.
Damn. Zelda doesn't do that stuff. Link's all about... Actually, to be fair, he's got a big sword, and he does hack up quite a lot of people. But he does it in a cutesy way.
Yeah, he does all the violence, but like, there's no blood or anything, so everyone's just like, nah.
You get away with it. It's sort of adorable when Mario crushes sentient fungus. Everyone goes, it's all right. He's got that nice moustache though, hasn't he? So the wholesale manslaughter of mushrooms with thoughts is fine.
Mushrooms with thoughts. Brilliant.
Well, it's my favourite Morrissey album. Anyway, what are we going to be doing on this week's episode 405? Let's talk about how you can get a SNES Classic Edition. Spoilers, you probably won't. We'll also be having a word about the new iPhone 8 and its potentially bezel-less screen, and another look at Mario plus Rabbids. It's nearly here. Glenn's played it for reals this time, and he's going to give us some opinions, plus all the new releases and a chat with voice actor Kay Bess about what it's like to perform vocal roles in video games. First up, the news. If you were in the UK and tried to get hold of a SNES Mini when they were launched for, about half a second between the page appearing and then all the stock being sold out. Too much stock, in fact, as they had to start cancelling pre-orders left and right. You might have thought that was it. That's going to be your only chance to get hold of one. However, they've got the Nintendo Classic Mini, which is the US version. So the one that is... probably an SNES Mini, if we're going to be proper full US and incorrect. You'll probably know it better as that boxy purpley one, which was actually my first contact with a SNES. When did you first get your mitts on one, Glenn?
You're going to hate me for this, James.
You don't tell me you've never touched a SNES.
I have, but it was 2017.
Oh, mercy.
Yeah.
Who's got one still plugged in nowadays?
My flatmate. Who's a obviously massive retro-obsessed nerd.
Of course, Steel Media luminary Simon Reed.
That's the one, yeah. Yeah, he plugged it in and he was like, do you want to play Mario Kart? And I was like, go on then. Assuming it was going to be Mario Kart 8, and it wasn't. It was done Mario Kart 1.
The original and best.
It's good, actually. I really like it.
It's very, very good. I've been playing it with my partner recently, who had a SNES when she was a kid. I did not. I was all Amiga-y and my brother had a Mega Drive, but we were not a Nintendo family. So I had to catch up later. But I played a lot of Mario Kart at the time because my mate had one and we went over there and I was obviously jealous.
Yeah, it's a good game.
It really is. Even though it's, you know, operating with, I would argue, you know, less complicated physics than your current Marios, and there's no flying bits where you jump into the air and a hand glider pops out the top of your craft and all of that business. But it's still really good, simple fun, especially the battle mode.
Oh, true, yeah. I haven't played the battle mode, actually, but I've heard that is the highlight of that one.
It's ever so good. It really is. It's amazing how much it stands up, not just with the nostalgia goggles. Her friend came over from Germany, and they were playing it and just screaming at each other on the sofa. And it was really fun to see, because it's just like, this game, it's still... We've always said within our little group that of all the games you could still plug into this day and give pads to whoever's in the room and happily sit down and play for an hour, that is one that still stands up. I do feel like with a lot of the nostalgia gaming we're getting at the moment, with all this, like, let's bring back, what was it recently? Crash Bandicoot came back.
True.
Went to number one, has done really well, and now they're moving on to Spyro, I think.
Oh, is that true?
I believe so. That was the chapter today, I think.
I need to Google this. I was just literally playing Spyro yesterday on my brother's PlayStation 3. God, I love that game.
See, you're part of the problem.
I know, I love it.
Then you had Ukulele, which was effectively Banjo-Kazooie, just, you know, redone, and they couldn't get the license, so they made it Ukulele. All these bits where they're just going to resell us the games that we played when we were younger, repackaged again, which I'm a little bit tired of. However, of all that kind of nostalgia gaming stuff that's going on, Mario Kart is one of the ones that does actually stand up. You don't need to change it. It's still really, really good. And I'd like to play one. I'd like to get this NES Classic. There is going to be another line released this month is when they're going to do it. The SNES Classic Edition is going to be available for pre-order in America and America only. And like with the other one, I imagine they will sell out in a nanosecond. However, we're going to be keeping a very close eye on it all. So if you want to see when it goes live, then we suggest you tune your feeds to Pocket Gamer. And the moment it goes live, we will scream, good chance by the time you see it, it'll still be gone.
Yes.
Now, the iPhone 8. So we've been speculating about what it could be for a little while now in terms of the new design philosophy and the little tweaks that are always made on incremental generations of the iPhone. And the way it seems to be going this time is towards all screen, no bezel.
I'm actually quite down for this.
This kind of follows the trend that most phones and digital devices and TVs have been going on for quite some time. If you go back to original TVs, and even the original iPad, the bezel on the outside of that, the border, was absolutely huge. And then it had what was a comparatively small screen in the middle of it. And over time, people have increased the screen real estate that you're holding and made less and less plastic around the edge, which makes sense because you want more screen and effectively the plastic bit is useless.
I saw some pictures. I don't know if that's exactly how it's going to appear, but I like the look of it. I mean, it'll be a shame to lose that physical button, but it's kind of a small price to pay for just having literally a screen as a phone.
Mm. Well, you hit upon that right, which was that this will mean, if it's all screen, that there will be no physical home button which you can jam your thumb into or get it to scan your fingerprints, which I would say perhaps is a downside, because you've always got that thing where if a screen freezes or if it locks up, then if you have at least one physical button, you can go, well, just turn off or reset or whatever. So even if the UI or the touchscreen stuff is playing up, there's always a way you can bypass it and go straight to a real good old-fashioned button. But then saying that, this new Xiaomi phone that I've got is basically that. It's got no physical home button. It's just got the three soft keys at the bottom of the screen.
Mm.
So I don't have a home button, but it doesn't matter because you've always got the power off, you know, on the side. You've still got that one physical button there which can override everything if you need to.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, it's kind of a common trend for people to put the touchscreen sensor on the back of the phone anyway, isn't it now? So
that's right, that's
right. It makes more sense, really, because, I mean, to me, it's not really natural to have my thumb at the base of the phone. I've always got a finger at the back of the screen.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think if that's what Apple's going to do, imagine it is, then that kind of makes sense, and they can kind of turn that into a physical button in the way if they want to.
Hmm. I'd like to use a phone like this where it's pure screen. I mean, I know that the Galaxy Edges, for example, they do have screens that wrap around and go right to the edge. It serves a slightly different function because it's off a jaunty 45-degree angle, so you can look at it from the side.
Mm.
You could put it up on a bookshelf, for example, and still be able to see, you know, a few icons. But you want to be able to hold on to the edge of the phone with the fingers maybe going around a little bit without it accidentally pressing a button of some kind. You know, like there is that issue where a bezel is actually a functional bit of the phone, as well as it just being an aesthetic that gets in the way of the screen, or is it a mounting for the screen at the center?
Yeah, that's true. I guess companies will find a workaround. Apple are one of those people who like to push technology in a certain direction, aren't they? They kind of want, like, you know, with Bluetooth headphones last year. So I imagine it's going to be something that they go, yeah, you're just going to have to get used to it, guys, unfortunately.
Well, one of the ways they're trying to prevent you rubbing your dirty fingers all over their beautiful screen is by eschewing the whole physical unlock thing altogether and just using your mush to do it. So apparently that the home button is going to be replaced by a 3D face mapping system.
Wow.
Where you just hold your phone up and it scans you in like you're in Tron. And then it unlocks because it recognizes you and is really pleased to see you because it's been in the drawer all night and it's well bored.
Yeah, I'm down for that. Again, like anything that just makes my life easier, I'm well down for. I'm not really one of those people who are scared of technological advances and robots and stuff. I just want an easy life.
You're not with Elon Musk on the fear of AI, then? You think it's all good? You want to give Skynet a big hug?
I mean, I definitely think that eventually robots are going to kill off humans, but I think there'll be a nice period before then where we all live really nice lives, so let's do it. And at the end of the day, we're going to kill ourselves off somehow. Might as well be robots. At least then the world has something inhabiting it.
I for one welcome our new robot overlords. Yeah, well, the 3D scanning stuff, that's fine. Facial recognition, we've already got the fingerprint technology. A little bit of a problem if you happen to be in a dark room, I would argue. I assume maybe the face is illuminated by the screen itself. Maybe they'll do something.
Yeah, hopefully.
That.
Hopefully the screen just turns on and is like, you need to stare at this, stare at me to unlock this. And I'm like, okay. Also, I don't know about you, but I find that, like, you know the little fingerprint sensor on the bottom that you have to press or put your finger on? I find that just that the more that gets clogged with grease, the more difficult... Yeah, it's disgusting, but the more difficult it is to get... You've got to, like, regularly clean it, but if it's just your face...
You still have to regularly clean your face, Glenn.
Yeah.
That's hygiene 101.
See, I can't be that lazy yet, can I? Not just yet, anyway.
And they're scanning you and the moss is interfering with the recognition software. You're gonna have to scrape it off, mate.
Mm. Damn it. Maybe I'll just hold up a photo of my face. Will that work?
Yeah, for when you were young and gorgeous. Yeah. Well, no, but that's the thing. It's 3D face mapping. Oh. You can't hold up a photo, presumably, because it's a 2D image. It's got that would be the way that people would hack your phone. They would just hold the phone up to the page of Facebook on your monitor and then break into your phone. No, it's got to be 3D.
Well, that is actually quite a smart thing to do. I like it.
Two cameras on the front, I guess.
See, now this is an improvement, like where you are all sat here going, yeah, Apple's got it bang on. Can you think of any downside to the whole idea?
Well, dark rooms is a problem. And I always have this underlying concern about scanning my body, giving my fingerprints, chromosomes, blood samples to large faceless corporations who then mine that data for profit.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, there's no real escaping it.
Like, your name is on file in a billion databases and everything. And this is where you sound already, like, paranoid. Yeah. But I still resist. Like, I never put my fingerprint on the Apple iPhone 6 that I've got. I always just unlock it with normal unlocks because I don't like the idea of putting my fingerprints into the machine or my face scans or any other part of my physical being because I don't want it on record somewhere. It's a bit... I don't really take many photos of myself and put them on Facebook, you know. Like, I'm a little bit concerned about that sort of thing, the massive sharing culture that we have, which isn't necessarily bad, but we give away more information every day, like, voluntarily, about what we're eating, where we're going, geotagging, checking yourself in on Foursquare, tagging it, I'm here, that back in the day, when you were an FBI dude trying to search somebody down, you would have to literally crawl into the wall spaces of hotels and set up, you know, mics and recording software and stake people out for 6 months to get a fraction of the information that we just spew every day voluntarily into the air, into the digital realm.
That's true.
And I find that a bit alarming.
Hasn't it made movies just way more boring now? Like, with detective movies, just watching a person filling in a spreadsheet online.
Well, it's become to, like, sir, we've got them. Oh, no, they're there.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just it. It's like, oh, well, we just traced their phone and they're there. Yeah. And actually, they just posted up something, a picture of the waffle they're eating on Instagram, and it's tagged as Bernie's Waffle House, so I guess they're there.
They're like, we can't find him. And you're just like, well, just look at a camera on his front of his laptop or his phone. You can watch where he's going. We can watch the guy live now.
And I'd like to state that I am not under the misapprehension that I'm so incredibly important that people are interested in or tracking my movements. No. But as with any giving up of data, once you have given it up, you can't get it back. So it's always that problem when you're talking about giving governments certain powers and in times of crisis, because even if you trust that particular government there, then the second or third or fourth government down the line will still have that power and they might be psychos. So. Yes.
I was going to say, that's why I kind of feel safe with an Apple product, because they've been kind of against the whole idea of governments just doing whatever they want with their stuff. So you're right there. No one's going to be watching me on my little MacBook. And if they are right now, you know, shame on you. There's nothing interesting going on here. But, like, it's the fact that they can, because I've seen it in the Snowden movie. That's what that's what worries me. It's there, James. It happens.
It's there because Oliver Stone and Joseph Gordon-Levitt did it.
They so did.
It's, so it's true. We're doomed. Yeah. Anyway, this stuff, I should say, this information has been pulled from an icon that was found in the middle of the HomePod speaker firmware. So this is like a third-party bit of software that has embedded in it an image which seems to suggest this information. Now, if that sounds like it's a little bit of a weak source for something, you might say yes, but it's embedded in code that Apple's signed off on, and we've been hearing sort of rumors about this for quite some time. So I think there's a fairly good chance this is going to come off as true, but still take it with a little pinch of salt. Finally, you have been playing Rabbids. Sorry. Finally, you've been in contact with Mario and Rabbids Kingdom Battle.
Yes.
You played it a while back, really, really quickly, but you've actually been able to get your mitts on it for a healthy amount of time recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I got like 5 hours with the game, which was cool. And it wasn't just the first 5 hours. They gave us like an hour with the beginning, a couple of hours with the middle, and then some time with the multiplayer as well. So I've kind of seen a broad part of it, and it's good. I like it.
We talked about it a bit at a previous podcast. If you've never heard of it before, it's basically Mario and Rabbids mixed with the gameplay of something like XCOM.
Yeah, it's very XCOM.
But this is unsurprisingly more about goofy fun stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there is challenge. It's just, it takes a bit of a backseat. Like, it's kind of on you to create that challenge. Like, if you want to go for the extra rewards and stuff, you can just kind of rush through the game and have a good time. The beginning of the game kind of keeps it simple. You mess around with the beginning move sets, which are like, you know, jumping off a ally to like cover more ground, because it's like turn-based, so you're moving across a grid, and you can only move like eight cells or something. But then if you bop off a hero, you can sort of double that movement. There's stuff like sliding and tackling into enemies if you can get close enough to melee hit them. The thing is, you can do crazy moves. You can just combine like loads of stuff together. Like, there's some stuff you can do during a round that is kind of a free move. You can go through warp pipes. Like I said, you can bounce off your allies to go further. That doesn't count as a move. There's a cover system, which is quite decent. Each sort of character's got different skills. Mario's focused on damage. Peach is focused on, like, healing. Luigi is a bit of a buffer. So there's lots of depth. I love it.
Well, August 29th is the release for that. So 3 weeks, and it will be in your hands and all of your switches. So keep your eyes on Pokegamer. We will, of course, be reviewing it and giving you all the info you need to know about it. We've spoken to developers and writers and designers on this podcast in the past, but we've yet to speak to any of the actors involved in bringing our favourite games to life. Until now, because we're very pleased to be joined by voice actor Kay Bess. Hello, Kay.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, you've done all manner of voice work spanning radio and TV, but you've also offered your voice to the world of gaming as well.
Yes.
So what kind of games have you appeared in thus far that we might have heard of?
Well, I'll tell you, I'm relatively new to it. You know, I've been at it for the last 3 years or so. The first game I ever voiced a character for was Skylanders, and just a small character, Queen Cumulus, in Skylanders Superchargers. And then shortly after that, I landed the role of Anna in Lara Croft Rise of the Tomb Raider, which was just a fantastic experience and a great game and great character. And then I have Agents of Mayhem is released August 15th, in which I play Persephone Brimstone. She's sort of the leader of all of these agents, and she too is a fantastic character. You can't play the game without interacting with me. I'm not a playable character in that, but you can't escape me.
I like that. You're omnipresent throughout.
Yeah, exactly. I am somewhat omnipresent.
Now, we're a mobile gaming podcast, and some people might be wondering why we're chatting specifically today, but we've spoken to people in the past on Pocket Gamer and on AppSpy about the process of recording voices for games, and we've interviewed actors in the past, and whether it's PC or console or mobile, it basically comes down to you in a room with a script and a microphone.
Yes.
Now, as you've mentioned, you've done work on things like on TV and on radio. How does recording a voice for a video game differ from those other disciplines, from TV and radio?
Yeah, they are quite different. I mean, there's a common through line, you know, through all of it. But it is a very different thing. And at the root of doing games is acting skill. And so I find that it's imperative to possess a pretty good toolbox of acting skills and the ability to use your imagination, because as you say, we're alone in a studio with a microphone and a director. You know, I mean, I played almost all of the scenes I did in Rise of the Tomb Raider were with Camilla Luddington, who played Lara, and I've never met her. I've never been in the same room with her, you know? And so it's also a point where directors are so crucial because they're able to lay out what the scene is and what you are responding to, because we don't get the entirety of the script. We only get our lines. And so that's really the collaborative nature of it, that the director is setting the scene for us and letting us know who we're talking to, what we're saying, what the circumstances and all of that. So it's really the ability to imagine, to place yourself in that scenario very quickly, whereas doing a narration for a documentary or doing a commercial, you also have to engage your imagination. But oftentimes you're reading two picture, you get the entire script, you know, you get the whole of the project. So you understand your place in it. You know, I always like to say that in narration and commercials, you're kind of a dispassionate observer to what is going on, you know, to the story that's being told on the screen, you know, and the emotion that is being evoked by the music. And we just do our part, you know, we illuminate the story just that much more. That's the major difference, you know, that it's really acting skills as opposed to the quality of your voice, you know, the sound of your voice, right? That's what's so important in other things. Is my voice pleasant? You know, is it compelling?
Sure, less,
you know,
it's less aesthetic and more about emotional content,
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, with Anna in Rise of the Tomb Raider, she's sort of an interesting character, and without getting into spoilers of what she goes through and what happens, it's all played very naturalistic. The tone isn't over the top or cartoonish, and I get the feeling that certainly if you're voicing, you mentioned something like Skylanders and other games, there's the chance to go quite big with it and to be quite sort of, you know, be a cartoonish villain or hero or whatever it might be.
Absolutely.
Is it tough to convey range and nuance of emotion without the help of body language, first of all? And also, is there an instinct or an impulse that you have to pull back from going big because you're just using your voice? Do people overact when they start out in this gig and then pull back gradually as time goes on? Or
I think that's a really interesting question, and I think it depends upon where you come from in your acting career. I think if you come from the stage, I've known a few voice actors who began on the stage, and they are, they're just so fantastic for games, right? Because there's something broad and rather theatrical about most games, even the ones that are more naturalistic in tone. We are conveying something, you know, larger than, you know, just a camera that's close up on our face where you barely lift an eyebrow and it's a whole new expression, you know?
Yeah.
I think that people who come from, actors who come from television, have the opposite problem, if you will, that they're so subtle because you naturally rely upon body movement, facial expression for conveying the slightest nuance, you know, in a change of emotion or anything. I mean, I've done voiceover for 30 years, and I came right out of an acting program at USC in Southern California. And I think there was a new thing, a new wave of voiceover coming along right at that time, which was more understated and more natural sounding. And so that's exactly where I live, you know, it came quite naturally to me, but animation did not come naturally to me. That was an area that I kind of avoided because it was so broad. And I felt like, I don't really know if I have that in me, you know? And it's taken all this time to realize that it's just, you know, it's really just play.
I've watched a lot of world cinema and anime, and in the West, we've got a lot of imported cartoons and things from the East. And there's a slightly different recording process for those versus animation that's created, like from the root. So I don't know if people know this. If they don't, generally speaking, voice actors will record their voices for an animation first, and then animators will take that voice and then animate to it.
Yes.
If there's lip sync involved for a cartoon or a video game, for example.
Yes. However,
when dubbing's done from another country, say you got a Japanese cartoon, basically actors are given the script when they show up in the studio, and then they have to try and make the the words in the language that they're speaking fit the voice movements of the characters by watching playback and do it that way. Have you done both, and how challenging is that?
Okay, well, this is cool, because for Rise of the Tomb Raider, I actually replaced an actor in the role.
And okay.
There's a lovely actor, Laura Waddell is her name, and she's great. I do believe she's a Brit, and she did all the motion capture, the performance capture for the role.
I was going to ask. Okay.
Yeah. And so she's, you know, she has credit, you know, for the role as well as I do, because she put in a lot of hard work, you know, into it. And I think nearing the end of the production of the game, they realized that they wanted Anna to have a different voice. And so I think that's why they brought in an American voice in that role.
To counterpoint Lara's kind of British.
Yes. Thing. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so I got to do both of those things for that role. You know, there was a lot that had yet to be animated, but there was quite a bit that already was. And so I recorded a lot of lines to Lara's lip flaps, Laura Waddell, her, you know, lip flaps, as they call them. I don't know if they use that same term where you are, but
that's a new one on me. No, I haven't heard that.
Lip flaps, okay. Isn't that hilarious? Yeah,
right on.
And that's so I got to do both, and so which I found really interesting, because she had very different phrasing than I do, and so I had to match her phrasing, even though. So in many ways, there are a few scenes where the rhythm of a reply, you know, really that rhythm belongs to Laura Waddell. You know, it wasn't mine. My voice is there, but it was her speech pattern, if you will. So that's a challenge. I think that dubbing, you know, is quite a challenge. Whatever emotional content you're in the midst of in conversation or in battle or in, you know, whatever, you're not only bringing that aspect of it to the work, but then you're like, you know, really having to be technical with, you know, timing and, you know,
a mimicry almost of what someone else or you've already performed, because you get it a lot in films as well. They call it ADR over there, or additional dialogue recording. Yep. But Lord of the Rings movies, for example, you look at those, and like 85% of all the voices you're hearing have been recorded after the fact. They've been recorded in ADR. Yes. So everyone's trying to match the performance that they did like 3 months ago.
I know. Yeah. It's crazy, that piece. I've done some ADR, and it's really a skill unto itself. For sure.
I don't know if some people feel like, some people, I think, try and use voice acting or certain types of acting as a way to get onto television or get into films rather than an end in and of itself.
Yeah.
Which almost seems like a shame, because it's kind of one of the coolest things to do, I would think.
Yes.
But I often wonder if you feel that there is a benefit to that kind of anonymity, or are voice actors frustrated screen actors?
You know, I think there are both. I love the anonymity of it. I'm quite introverted, and yet I love acting. And so it's, for me, it's the best of both worlds. I get to do the thing I love, and it's difficult to describe being an introvert. Just, I think, because so many people associate acting with sort of wanting to be on stage and be seen and have, you know, cameras in your face and all that stuff is like, I just kind of run, you know, from it. But I think that there are, well, I'll say that most of the voice actors that I know, and I know a lot of them, they do view it as an end unto itself, that they are not frustrated screen actors, not in the least. They recognize it as an art form, if you will, you know, collaboratively, you know, that gaming and commercial making and all of that, they are distinct art forms unto themselves, and they like being a part of that. They like being a link on that chain, you know. So, man, when I started, there just wasn't the influx of people who wanted to do voiceover. It was really quite a hidden thing, you know. It was sort of a secret society, you know.
I think back in the very early days of video games, you got a lot of cases where they would just get their friends to do it, because there were very small developers with no budgets and things like that, and that's why you got what could be charitably called questionable voice acting in the early days.
Yeah, I have to say too that in the early days of gaming, you know, I mean, I did a couple of games, 10 or so years ago, I don't even know what they are. I mean, I don't, it's like, just go to the studio and you're going to record some stuff.
What's the craziest thing you've been asked to do, like voice-wise? Have they asked for specific bonkers accents, or have they just said, just go crazy, or are there any weirder experiences that you've had?
Well, I have, you know, I played a couple of different characters in this upcoming game, Agents of Mayhem, which are really fun. I play sort of a crazed fan of one of the agents who was his name is Hollywood, and he used to be, you know, some like a television actor. And so I got to play kind of a crazy person, a stalker, if you will, which was really fun. But Persephone Brimstone, the character that I play, that's the largest of the, you know, a main character. I do sort of a Euro French accent with her.
Oh, I see.
Which was really fun. And, you know, I say Euro, you know, because it, you know, it takes the pressure off of me having like a perfect Parisian
accent.
You know, it's not quite perfect, but but there was when I auditioned for that role, there was a woman in my acting class who is of Iranian descent, but she grew up in Paris, and so she had this really beautiful, mellifluous sort of French accent that was otherworldly. And so when I was auditioning for the role, I got a call back. I mean, truly, the first time I auditioned for the role, it was like one line. And I thought, I can do a French accent for one line. You know, I didn't know how large the role was, you know. So, and then when I got a call back, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have to like really figure out how to do a French accent. So, anyway, so I watched her and I listened to her and I watched the way her mouth moved and I watched the way she sort of held her, you know, her body and what her facial expressions were like and stuff like that. So I ended up with this accent that they clearly liked, you know, and thought, okay, that's what we're after. It was, you know, there was a sophistication about it. If it's possible for a French accent to be any more sophisticated, you know, I think hers was. It just had, I don't know, it had a different quality to it, but, again, those are all things that are kind of just in the tool bag, right? You got to draw on them and pull them out and like, okay, how am I going to, you know, finesse this thing? But I do think that the most challenging and difficult thing about voice acting is, you know, battle work, you know, and the shouting, the dying, you know, how many ways can you die, right? I mean, it's...
Yeah.
And...
Well, you've done work on Mass Effect Andromeda, which came out recently, wasn't it?
Yes.
And you've done stuff in the Call of Duty franchise, too?
Yes, I did. I did actually a lot of work in Call of Duty Infinite Warfare. My characters did not have names, per se, but I played a synaptic soldier, which is essentially, and I'm talking in your head, right, and telling you where... Yeah. You know, where the targets are everywhere. And then I also did a lot of incidental work in the downloadable content, you know, for a lot of cutscenes and things like that, where I was doing all kinds of different characters. And there was some taxing work in that, although not as much as I, you know, some other friends who were seriously on the battlefield, you know.
Do you get yourself out of breath? Do you do sprint up and down the room a little bit, or is it pure acting?
You know, I think that you kind of, that's such a strange thing, because I did some work a couple months ago for a game where, you know, I had to be running. I was running through some circumstance, but you just kind of stand there and start going,
yeah,
you know, and so, and it's so easy to hyperventilate. I mean, like, it's pretty funny, but those are the kinds of things that are challenging. And as of yet, I haven't been in a circumstance where I've been like seriously worn out, you know, by a session.
Well, you mentioned a podcast earlier on that you host as part of a focus on voice actors and women in voice acting. What's the name of that and where can they find it?
The name of the podcast is The Beehive, Women in Voiceover. And it's B, you know, just the letter B dash hive. Women in Voiceover, you can find it on iTunes. And I think I'm on Stitcher. And you can also find it on the website itself, which is thebeehivepodcast.com.
by pure coincidence, listened to it a while back, and it was one with Jennifer Hale you were talking Lassie from Mass Effect, who's, I'm a big Mass Effect fan, and I always played as her, as Femme Shep, as it's called.
Yes, Femme Shep.
And she was a big part of what made it work for me, because when I went back and tried it with the male voice actor, I don't know his name, and no discredit to him, but it wasn't as good, anywhere near as good, and there was something. I think that character engaged in a big way, particularly her performance of it, because you have this strange thing where there are two performances running parallel to one another, you know, the male voice and the female voice, and everyone locked into her performance more than the other guy.
Yeah, she's a great actor. I've known Jennifer for a really long time. And, you know, we kind of grew up in voiceover together, and we took different paths. You know, there was a period of time, I think I mentioned it earlier, where we just kind of got sent out on jobs for games, and we didn't know what they were. And I remember being asked to scream. I mean, I got called in to do a particular role, then they asked me to do another role, all of which was, you know, totally cool. And then at the end of the session, they were like, okay, we need for you to do some screaming. And I said, oh, I don't scream. I mean, and again, I wasn't unwilling to scream. I felt like I don't really scream. Like, how do you scream? And so they were like, okay, you know, and then, so I didn't do any screaming.
Oh, okay.
And, but then after that, I was like, I don't know if I want to do these games. Like I was just in such a different space, you know, of my voiceover career, and didn't really recognize it as something where, wow, this is really a place where you get to exercise some acting skills and all of that. And whereas Jennifer was like, oh, I'll, you know, I'm in, I'm just going to, you know, and so she was saying on the podcast, like, oh, I just took every role that came my way. Like, nobody knew what it was, but I just, you know, I took everything. I said yes to everything.
Sure.
And so, so to find myself sort of coming back around, you know, to this genre of voiceover is wild. And having Jennifer really as a, you know, I really admire her work, and I admire her work ethic as well. And Sissy Jones, are you familiar with Sissy Jones?
No.
She's a fantastic voice actress as well, who is really very new to games, and yet she just won a BAFTA for her role as Delilah in Firewatch.
And, oh, she's Delilah.
Yeah,
oh,
she's
fantastic.
Delilah. Yeah. And so Sissy and I, again, you know, we're very good friends. We do a workout group on Wednesday nights where we bring copy, you know, we bring copy and we work on it together, and we just keep trying to get better at what we're doing, and we help each other, you know. It's a really lovely thing about voice actors is that we, yes, we're in competition for everything. You know, I read on everything that Jennifer reads on, I'm reading on, same with Sissy. And we all just kind of celebrate with each other our wins, and we are, you know, sympathetic to each other for our losses, you know. I look to Jennifer as kind of a comrade from, you know, way back, and I look to Sissy as someone who is new and fresh and has a lot of insight that comes from a very different, you know, perspective, you know, in the timeline, you know. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Pretty cool. Very lucky. Very fortunate. And I think that's why I stay, you know, aside from I started, you know, to do on-camera stuff, and it was like, wow, this is not the same world. It's so competitive in a way that's very, I don't know, you just feel looked over, you know, and I suppose that's my introverted nature coming out, like, don't look at me.
But listen.
Please do. Please listen.
Out and about this week, not super high profile releases, but a few things of note, starting with Holy Potatoes, a weapon shop, which I think is how you have to pronounce it. If you look at the title and you see the number of exclamation points and question marks in it, I think that's the inflection that you need to go for.
Oh, definitely.
I'm really focusing on inflections now since I've talked to a voice actor, so you've got to put the theory in behind it. What is it? It's a game about owning a workshop which builds weapons for potato men.
Yeah. I can see the logical progression there. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing. It's almost got an art style that looks a little bit Adult Swim. It looks a bit Adventure Time, which is coincidental, as there's an Adventure Time game out this week, which we'll talk about in a second. But the idea is that you're supposed to gather materials in order to create things like bows and blades and axes and then sell them on. You have to make sure that the people who are working for you, your smiths, make sure they're all paid. So it's that kind of management area of the game. If you look at it, it's isometric, top-down. There's a lot of pop-up GUI stuff because it does feel a bit like that whole managing lots of disparate elements, Farmville, you know the kind of thing. But with this slightly surreal enterprise, we actually liked it quite a lot. Like, Harry gave it an 8 out of 10 and said it was, despite, you know, a few issues, really, really quite great and fun and has a sense of humor and is actually quite challenging. And importantly, quite an original idea as far as these games go.
Mm-hmm.
So that may well be worth your time. Holy Potatoes, a weapon shop. That's out right now. Adventure Time Run. It's an Adventure Time game where you run.
Yeah, I saw this and I was just like, okay, I'm going to give this the benefit of the doubt. Surely there's something here that's a little bit interesting. But no, it's just an endless runner with Adventure Time characters.
But Glenn, what about the bit where you go through a funny portal and then it stops being an auto runner and starts being like a shmup where you have to scroll up the screen and shoot people suddenly without warning for no reason?
What, is that a thing?
Yeah, that's a bit in it. I've played this. So yeah, it's your standard three-lane style auto runner of the Temple Run cast. You have to do jumps and slide under things and, you know, the standard thing that you're used to. You've played Subway Surfers, you know how this works, only it's in the Adventure Time universe. But the little twist on the formula I saw is that you go through portals and then instead of running like high speed down the road, you start running very slowly down the road and you're firing automatically and you have to slide left and right. The three lanes go away and it becomes much more just like an analog thing, like Space Invaders. And you have to shoot the people who are slowly approaching you. And then once you've killed them all, you run and you jump back into the normal endless runner mode.
Okay.
And it kind of throws it all at you within the first 50 seconds. Not brilliant onboarding, I'll use the word again, for this. And I'm not really impressed. It's just another one of these with a slightly new thing that doesn't work especially well for me.
Yeah, I'll pass.
Adventure Time Run, the Ooh Expedition, as it's called. I'm sure it's free, and that's out on the various devices. Something properly different. Songbirds. So I had a quick go on this before I started. This is one of those interactive visual music creators. So instead of having to type notes into, you know, tablature of some kind or really have any knowledge of music theory whatsoever, it's one that's presented entirely graphically. It's got a few different modes. The first one gives you four different channels, if you like, four different songbirds you can choose from. So you pick the songbird from the right-hand side of the screen, and then you draw your finger around the screen. And it will create like a joined-up constellation of stars. And each one of those stars is a note, and then when you release your finger, the bird will fly across the line you've drawn, going do, 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 as it hits all the different notes you've chosen. Okay. Then you can select another bird and draw a bunch of different lines and a new pattern, and then it will be in a different octave, usually a different register. And sometimes it will be operating on a different time signature as well. And then that bird will play back its notes in addition with the first bird. So you've got two melodies running simultaneously. Then you can do it again, then you can do it again. And it creates this little stacked up, multi-layered song-style loop. And it's, as someone who plays music and enjoys it, I am 100% behind these things, which allow people who aren't schooled in music theory or even, you know how to play an instrument, to give you that little thrill of, oh, I made a song, I made a sound, and I put some sounds together, and now it sounds nice. Like, I'm a big fan of that because it's making creativity accessible to people. And it's presented very nicely here. It's quite minimal. The emphasis seems to be on some quite chilled out sounds and moods. It's not, you're not going to be making any banging techno with it. It's very much like, like chilled out stuff. In fact, there's one of the modes which has no beat really, and it is just you creating kind of these pan synth soundscapes. Which I quite like. But I've only played it for about 15 minutes or so. I had a quick dabble. I'm not sure if it's amazing. It's £1.99 or $1.99. I know there are a bunch of these things out there. I think we might do a review on it and see how it stacks up against the other alternatives. But in theory, I am behind it. It makes noises. I like making noises and stuff. So, you know.
It's interesting. Cool.
Now, the game that you're most interested in this week, which we neither of us had a chance to play because it only just appeared on the App Store account, is Eglia, Legend of the Red Cap.
That's
What's
right.
this all about?
Yeah, so you know I'm obsessed with JRPGs.
We are aware of this from yes. your Tales explanations last week.
I'm still playing that, but let's not talk about that because I could talk all day about that. But basically, Eglia, Legend of the Red Cap, is a brand new JRPG by a supergroup of JRPG legends. The main person is from the Mana series. He worked on a few of those.
The Secret of Mana games.
Yes, should make that clear. Yes, he worked on several of those. It's a RPG with a side of city building, which is kind of a popular mobile thing. People like it, don't they? They like building little towns. So you go out, beat up some monsters with big swords and stuff, and then you earn resources, you go back and build a little city. So it'd be nice. Go play it.
We were talking about this nostalgia cash-in business, and your Freudian slip calling it Legend of the Recap instead of Red Cap, I think is quite apt,
yeah.
considering what it is. Because it really is, you know, let's do this again. Let's do another Secret of Mana. Now, it's not 16-bit graphics, I should hasten to add. It is actually 3D-style, more up-to-date-looking visuals. But the principle is there, and it's, you know, elements of the same team, and it's already done very well on Google Play, even though it costs £9.99, a premium app of impressively priced proportions actually selling on Google Play.
Yep.
Who'd have thought it?
It is an expensive game, but it looks quite fun.
But it's got loads of ratings already, and it's already got like around 10,000 installs within like a couple of days. So that's sort of impressive. It is out now on iPhone and on iPad. We will be reviewing this. I say we, probably you, Glenn.
Yes, that's right.
We'll be taking a look at this, so check back if you want to find out whether it is indeed worth your £10 or not. Finally, we've got Noded, which is a game that, for me, reminds me of... Remember when you got those little toys as a kid, where it was like a plank of wood with a load of nails punched into it, and then you could take an elastic band and then wrap it around the nails, and you could like make shapes?
I don't think I... Oh, wait, yes, I know what you're talking about. I did that in primary school a lot.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So imagine that. It's a game where you're presented with a series of nodes, so imagine the nodes are nails, and a shape wrapped around it, like elastic bands. So it's making these geometric shapes as a black line. And then the game presents you with an image at the top of the screen, another geometric shape, and says, right, you've got to turn the bottom shape into the top shape in the fewest moves possible. And the way that you move it around is by tapping the nodes. And if you tap one of the nodes, it's effectively like pulling the pin out.
Okay.
So pulling the nail out. And the elastic band will go boom, and it will fire out as propelled by the two nearest elastic band nodes, you know, it's attached to. And that's the way that it works. So kind of by doing that, it does a mirror image of the position it was previously in, as if it had gone twang and fired over to the other side. And that's how it works. So you have to tap the nose, keep tapping, and re-sculpting this shape until it makes the shape at the top. I've played this for a little while as well. It's actually quite fun. It's very simple. I don't think it's the most attractive game. There are rules set up so that the nodes are all circular, but then they start introducing hexagonal nodes, which if you tap them, it'll change all the nodes of the same color at the same time. And they introduce other rule sets as well to make it more challenging. I like it because I tend to lean towards these puzzly things involving nonverbal reasoning because I'm apparently just that nerd. But I enjoyed the time I spent with it. It's not the prettiest game, I don't think, but mechanically seems sound. It is out on iPhone at the minute. I think it's premium, 99 pence or 99 cents. It is. Noded is the name. You can get it right now.
There is one more exciting release this week.
Go on then, hit me.
Miracle Merchant. Have you heard of this?
I have not. Fill me in.
So, you know Card Crawl and Card Thief?
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's another one of those, but this one, you're an alchemist.
Oh, snap. I'm looking at it now. Ooh, this looks a little bit more like cartoony and colourful, because Card Thief was quite sort of sombre and grey.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. The idea behind this one is they wanted to make one that kids could play or that you could play with your kids. So it's kind of a little bit more of a child-friendly version. You sort of play as an alchemist's apprentice, and you've got to like match cards together to create little potions, which you then sell. So it looks kind of cute and fun. And it's apparently going to be a lot less... I wouldn't say that Card Crawl and Card Thief were particularly difficult, but it's going to be less challenging and more beginner-friendly. So I think it looks quite nice.
It does. I've always loved their art style, and both Card Crawl and Card Thief are excellent.
Yes,
and I think they're both done very well as well. They've been commercially successful, so it's quite nice to see stuff like that being rewarded. So I will definitely play this, even if it is slightly more goofy. I'm up for it. They're clever folks, the guys behind that lot, the team. I think it's Tiny Touch Tales is the name of the publisher.
Yeah, that's the one, yeah. I'm down for this, definitely.
Excellent. All right, then, so Miracle Merchant, that came out just today, and you can get it for $1.99 or £1.99.
Cheaper than I thought. Cool.
Not too bad. All right, then, we'll wrap it up for this week. Thank you for listening. Probably a slightly longer episode, but don't hold it against us. Join us next week when hopefully we'll have the full team back together for more news, reviews, and chatter. Like, rate, subscribe, etc., etc. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Thanks, guys.